This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our program tonight on Keeping the Faith is a very special archive program recorded originally in April of 1999, the very first month Keeping the Faith was on the air, and coincidentally the very first time Roger Ebert was hosting the Overlooked Film Festival here in Champaign, Illinois at the Virginia Theater. Since that time, Roger Ebert has sadly lost his ability to speak due to throat cancer, so we're delighted to be able to bring this archive program where we can actually all hear his voice again. Again, the information you'll be hearing is about the first Overlooked Film Festival. Remember that the current one for 2012 starts on April 25th, Wednesday. This very coming Wednesday. Hope people can come and get tickets and enjoy the festival. Let me remind listeners that WILL is able to bring you these kind of programs because for 90 years we've been serving this community. If you'd like to make a pledge to help us continue, the number is 244-9455 in 217 area code or online at willpledge.org. This is Steve Shoemaker with Keeping the Faith, and today our guest is Roger Ebert. Roger is a Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, and is it the Bravo TV network that has your TV show?
It's a syndicated show, syndicated by Disney. It's on about 200 stations around the country.
I see.
I also do certain things for Bravo, such as the Cannes Film Festival.
Ah, very good.
Uh-huh.
Roger is also a native of Urbana, Illinois, and a graduate of the University of Illinois, where this week he's doing something brand new. He's having an Overlooked Film Festival sponsored by the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Roger, how did that come about?
Well, of course, you know, Steve, that we did the Cyberfest a couple of years ago on the occasion of HAL 9000's birthday party.
The great computer, yes.
Yeah, the computer in 2001 who was born in Urbana. And at that time, we showed 2001 in 70mm at the Virginia Theater, and it was a sold-out house and a great evening. People came from all over the country and even from Australia to see that film.
Now, for novices like me and others, how is 70mm different than what people ordinarily see?
Well, it's twice as the film itself, as it goes through the gate, is twice as wide, so it has four times as much surface area, which simply means that much more depth and detail and richness on the screen.
Would it be fair to say it's more high definition?
Yes, it would. Yeah, much more. And anyway, after that event, the College of Communications, Kim Rotzel, the dean, and Nancy Casey, the associate dean, asked me to do a film festival in Urbana. I think somebody recalled that it was originally going to be a 70mm film festival, although that goes back a long ways. Anyway, I originally declined because a film critic can't be in the position of asking studios for favors, such as give me your new film.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought, well, what about an Overlooked Festival of films that deserve more attention than they've received? Because every movie critic has a personal list of movies that he loves, that he has seen, and that he thinks didn't get a fair shake in the marketplace, especially in these days of mass bookings of 3,000 teenage slasher pictures all over the country every Friday, and then 2 weeks later you've forgotten them, but there's another one. And the movies that require a little more of a specialized sell in order to reach more discriminating viewers are lost in the shuffle.
So you've selected how many films to be seen this week at the University of Illinois? It's the Virginia Theater, isn't it?
Yeah, we're going to show 10 films.
10 films.
One of them is a free matinee on Saturday morning. I don't know if a matinee can be in the morning, but anyway, at 10 o'clock Saturday, we're showing Shiloh. It's a family film about a boy who falls in love with a dog, and the dog falls in love with him, but the dog unfortunately belongs to a neighbor who is abusive and pretty cruel. And that film is free. If you have a family group and you want to bring them, it's not just for kids. It's a very interesting, well-acted, intelligently directed film that would be of interest to adults as well as to kids.
And so that'll be a first-come, first-served basis at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, 10 a.m. Saturday.
I don't know if it's first-come, first-served.
Oh, it's not. You can get tickets?
The tickets are free.
Uh-huh.
But you'd have to call the festival to find out Maybe you have to have a ticket even if it's free. I don't have any idea.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So if people want to find out, they call the Virginia Theater. Excellent.
I think there's a 217 number that's been widely publicized.
I can give you that number. It's 356-9063.
That's the number.
And it is in the area code 217. I'll repeat that number for tickets for not only the free show, but the other ones are practically free. The tickets are $30 to get into all the movies. And I think it's just $5 a ticket.
$5 a ticket or $30 for a festival pass. And that's even a better deal than it sounds like, because we're going to have so many people in person with their films, directors, producers, and stars. Some people are coming from long way away to be at the festival, and of course our opening film is going to have the most dramatic guest. The opening film at 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon is called Dance Me to My Song, and I saw this film at the Cannes Film Festival last May. It was an official entry. Out of 500 movies, 18 are selected to be official entries.
Mm.
And it stars a woman named Heather Rose, who has cerebral palsy and communicates with a computerized voice synthesizer. Well, Heather Rose is a real woman who wrote the movie and who stars in it and who's coming all the way from Australia to be at the festival. And she's going to do a Q&A. And it's just a remarkably strong and powerful film about a woman who is trapped, not so much by the disease of cerebral palsy as by a cruel caregiver paid for by the state who is basically stealing her money and mistreating her. And so this young woman's goals are to escape from the caregiver and to meet a guy. She wants to meet a guy, and she does.
Now, Roger, I may be overly sensitive to these issues, but I'm detecting a theme here in the two films you've described so far, and that is that there seems to be problems with this, since this is a show on religion and ethics and values and so forth, a problem with evil that some of these characters are having to face, whether it's cruelty toward a dog or a caregiver of someone with cerebral palsy.
Well, you could say that. There are various themes that could emerge. One reason for showing Dance Me to My Song is that the University of Illinois and Champaign-Urbana as communities are so in the forefront of education for the handicapped, for people in wheelchairs.
With wonderful...
Handicapped isn't the right word. What's the word we use?
Challenged. Challenged. People who have physical challenges, mental challenges, right?
That's what I'm looking for. I'm too old-fashioned. But in any event, this film will be of very great interest to the people involved with the Rehabilitation Institute, and also to general audiences. But some of the other films also involve confrontations with evil. One interesting film is you've got the list in front of you.
Household Saints, 13.
What? Oh, Hamsun.
Ah.
Hamsun. Knud Hamsun was a Norwegian poet who won the Nobel Prize. And then in his advanced years in the 1930s and 40s, he drifted into the orbit of the Nazi Party and became a Nazi sympathizer and was seduced by this evil ideology, to much to the disappointment and dismay of those who admired his work. And this is a movie that stars Max von Sydow, who was the...
well-known from Bergman films.
Best-known star in Bergman Pictures.
Right.
And directed by Jan Troell, who is a great Swedish director. Hmm. It's a Danish film about a Norwegian, directed by a Swede.
And that'll be Saturday at 1 p.m., April 24th. Let me give the number again for any listeners who would like to get tickets for a single performance or perhaps for the whole series. It's 356-9063. That's 217-356-9063 for Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival this week, starting on Thursday afternoon. And at 3 o'clock and going through Saturday.
3, 6, and 9 on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, isn't it?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then there's a 10 o'clock movie on Saturday and a midnight movie on Friday night.
Ah, very good.
One film, when you're talking about ethics and religion and evil and so forth, that you might find interesting is Household Saints, directed by Nancy Savoca, who is one of the best female directors in America today. And this stars a great cast, including Lily Taylor and Judith Malina, who plays her grandmother. It's three generations of an Italian-American family. And the grandmother is a devout Catholic who believes the traditional pre-Vatican II worldview of the church, lock, stock, and barrel. Her children become secularized, modernized, middle-classed yuppies, and kind of drift away from the more fundamental teachings of the church. But then the third generation, the character played by Lily Taylor, wants to become a saint. She actually wants to become a real saint, just like the lives of the saints that we studied in school. I studied at St. Mary's Catholic Grade School in Champaign. And, of course, her behavior seems crazy to her parents, but would make perfect sense to her grandmother. So it's about changing values over three generations in terms of how we relate to religion and to spirituality. It's also a very perceptive and sometimes a very funny film. And, boy, I loved it when it came out. I'm at a loss. Well, I'm not at a loss to know why it didn't do better, because even in explaining it to you, I suppose it sounds a little complicated compared to the simplistic plots of most of the big movies these days. You know, like the Titanic is pretty easy to get your mind around. The biggest ship in the world, and it goes down.
Right.
It's not real subtle.
Well, Household Saints, I look forward very much to seeing in a on screen. I have been able to pick it up in a in video. It's not easily available, but I did find it. I made some effort after I read about it coming here, and I did find it fascinating. Tracy Ullman plays the daughter-in-law of the grandmother, and it was
Vincent D'Onofrio is the son.
Uh huh. And it's interesting that both of them pray eventually. Tracy Ullman's character prays after she's had some miscarriages for a child, and as she's giving birth finally to this daughter who wants to become a saint. Her husband prays as the child is being born, as I suppose many fathers do.
Yeah.
So although they are very secular, there are times in their life when even they felt it appropriate to pray. Now whether the granddaughter prays too much, I think is a very legitimate question.
Yeah, maybe she has gone a little overboard. That's a good question.
But it's a fascinating
film.
I
finally got in front of me the schedule for the festival. It's not 3, 6, and 9 all 3 days. It's 3, 6, and 9 on Thursday, 6, 9, and 12 on Friday, and 10, 1, 5, and 8 on Saturday.
Wow.
There's actually a website called ebertfest.com that has all the dope on it, but
I was going to mention that too. And incidentally, your own website is an excellent one. I've discovered.
The Sun Times.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of that because we do a couple of things there that are special loves of mine. I have a section of the Sun Times website called Great Movies, where I go back every other week and look at a great movie from the past and write a new, fresh review of it, because I'm concerned that people are losing touch of, you know, we've had a century of great films, and most people think that cinematic history began with Star Wars.
Right.
They seem to think that, so.
Well, I'm very pleased you're having some of the older films in your festival as well.
Well, we're going to have a silent film called Potemkin. And in the case of that film, it's not that the film is overlooked, it's one of the most famous movies ever made, but that the format, silent pictures, is often disregarded these days. I taught a class in silent films last fall at the University of Chicago, and I'm very, very fond of silent films. I think that they are a different art form from talking pictures and have, you know, some strengths that are unique to silent pictures. But what's interesting about Potemkin is that last summer I saw this film performed or shown at a little theater in Three Oaks, Michigan, which is a small town of maybe 3,000 people, and there's a theater there called The Vickers, run by a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Vickers. It's an art theater that is thriving, thriving. And they put a screen on the outside wall of their theater and showed Potemkin outdoors with a live performance by a three-piece orchestra from St. Joe, Benton Harbor, Michigan, an orchestra named Concrete. And not only did they sell out all their seats that they had for sale, but people lined up across the railroad tracks in the hardware store parking lot, and there were overflow on sidewalks and practically hanging from the lampposts, and everybody really enjoyed this silent Russian classic. And I thought, when I was planning The Overlooked, why not get those guys, get the Concrete guys down to the Virginia Theater, put them on stage, and give people the opportunity to see a silent film with a live orchestral soundtrack.
Wonderful. And that'll be Friday at 6 p.m.
Yeah, that's
the Battleship Potemkin.
Believe me, I've seen these guys play. And now we've got a 35-millimeter print of Potemkin restored with some extra footage in it. And in the case of all of the films, as far as we know, we are showing splendid 35-millimeter prints of these films. So it's going to be real good to see these films in a big theater, on a big screen, with good sound.
Let me remind folks that we're listening to Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL, and our guest today is Roger Ebert, noted film critic. If you're interested in making a contribution to WILL during this pledge period, the number to call is 217-244-9455. Roger, some people may think I'm being less than gracious by addressing you by your first name. I might explain
that.
We
went to high school together.
Well, we did. We were in high school together, and we had many, many arguments over the lunch table, as I remember, back when you were representing your Catholic school training, and I was representing my fundamentalist Protestant background. And as you may know, I've changed a bit since then, and I'm now pastor of a liberal Presbyterian church in Champaign called McKinley Presbyterian Church.
I know that.
And I suspect that maybe in your spiritual journey you might, I don't know, you may be the same or you might have changed. Would you be willing to share any of that?
Well, I probably have changed a great deal. I can remember our debates, and I think I was a little insufferable then.
So was I.
Were you? Well, I'm happy to hear that, Steve.
There, now we both confessed.
I know I was.
This really is a religious program.
Yeah. I'll tell you, the most important input into my thinking in the last 5 or 10 years has, oddly enough, been a group of writings on Darwinism, in particular River Out of Eden, a book by Richard Dawkins.
Ah, yes. Noted physicist.
British Darwin, modern Darwinist, who explains in words that most anybody can understand. It's not a simplistic book, but it's not a technical book. Darwin's theory of evolution, and which is not at all like the cliches of survival of the fittest and people, and animals fighting it out tooth and nail, but is more a case of evolution finding opportunities. And whether or not God set this plan into motion, of course, is a fundamental question. But what the book and other books that I started reading on the same subject have helped me to understand is how beautifully God's plan or nature's plan has unfolded over many, many, many long centuries and millennium. It's kind of inspiring. It's as if the notion that God created everything in 7 days seems kind of paltry compared to the portrait that's painted by somebody like Dawkins. It makes it look like a magic trick instead of like a wonderfully magistral, magical, enchanting, complex and beautiful process.
Some of the theologians who've been influenced by such physicists as Dawkins say that sort of notion of God supporting reality and continuously being involved in creation and evolution is certainly just as awe-inspiring as some of the sagas told in the Genesis material.
Oh, you know,
material.
We talk in church about following God's law, and we talk in school about the laws of nature, the fact that physical processes seem to take place in the same way here on Earth as they do on the furthest star that we can find with the Hubble telescope. Well, why would God set up this complex weave of laws that go from the greatest scale, galaxies, down to the tiniest little bit of something inside an atom, and then just suspend all of his laws in order to create heaven and earth and, you know, with a snap of his fingers, so to speak? Wouldn't he be more likely to follow his own laws, the ones that he created? Wouldn't he allow this wonderful creation to evolve according to principles which are now very accessible and increasingly understood by the mind of man?
I felt very fortunate to pastor a church that has many scientists in it at the University of Illinois here, and McKinley Church recently put in a couple of stained glass windows designed by a contemporary artist to celebrate, for example, a professor of chemistry here at the university, John Baylor, who for 40 years taught chemistry and was also very active in leadership in this particular congregation. And in that window are examples of all the sciences, from the birth of a planet to a birth of a baby, biology, astronomy, mathematics, chemistry, botany. And the window is trying to celebrate just that idea. And I think it's quite possible to be an excellent scientist and have a rigorous mind that uses logic excellently and still be a person of faith.
Well, I agree with that. It seems to me that God didn't give us minds in order for us not to use them.
Well, let me ask you to use your mind that's so well trained with films to help me with something. In one of your reviews I was reading, I have several of your books, partly because I've enjoyed knowing you over the years, but also because they're so handy. I like your movie yearbook that has a collection of all your reviews of films.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to waste time seeing junk. And
I hope I haven't misled you.
And it helps me a great deal to see what you give 4 stars to.
Okay.
And in one of your reviews, this was of Belle de Jour that Catherine Deneuve was in. Mm-hmm. You say that Brunel, is it Louis Brunel?
Louis Buñuel,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
You say that he's one of a small handful of the true masters of the cinema. And I wonder, with now decades of experience of seeing films, who else would you include in that small handful of true masters of the cinema, either living or dead?
Well, you might begin by asking what constitutes a master of the cinema, and one definition might be somebody whose work you can identify in a moment.
Hmm.
Seen a film, you know, you turn on the TV, let's say, and there's a movie playing. You've
right.
never seen the movie before. You don't have any clues. You may not even recognize the actors, but in 5 minutes, you know who directed it.
Hmm.
That would be true of any film by Buñuel, any film by Hitchcock, any film by Ozu, who is the great Japanese master.
Now, that's a name I don't know. How's that spelled?
Ozu.
Hmm.
One of the great humanists, Steve. You would love this man. Hmm. Movies like Tokyo Story and Early Spring and Drifting Weeds. I've got a couple of his reviews on my great movie site, reviews of his movies.
All right.
And he studied daily life in Japan.
Hmm.
Tokyo Story is one of the greatest of all films.
Hmm.
But another director would be Bresson, the French director.
Yes.
Made Pickpocket, which I just reviewed on the Great Movie site 2 weeks ago.
Hmm.
Probably Kubrick. Oddly enough, if you know what to look for, you can spot a Spielberg film right away.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly John Ford.
Altman?
Yes, you can.
These are pretty varied.
Notice certain things about, especially his ensemble use and his interlocking stories. Keaton, I think, is maybe the greatest director-actor in the history of the cinema. I would really rank him above Chaplin. And
Woody Allen, since we're talking comics for a moment?
No, I don't think Woody Allen would quite be in my Masters of the Cinema.
Really?
He would be in the... He's sometimes a very good director.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd try to keep my my list of the very best
mm-hmm.
to maybe around 10. Renoir from France would be another one. Michael Powell from England might be one that would belong on the list.
No, I don't know Michael Powell.
Michael Powell made The Red Shoes. Did you?
Oh, okay. I have seen that.
Yeah, and The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
I have not seen that.
Black Narcissus with Deborah Kerr as the nun in the Himalayas.
Oh, yes.
Peeping Tom, the shocking film about an abused child who grows up to become a murderer.
And a minister should see that, you think?
Well, Michael Powell is the director who most influenced Martin Scorsese.
Really?
Hmm. And Scorsese has been behind the restoration and revival of many of his films, and also collaborated with Powell on soundtracks for several Laserdiscs, where the two of them sit side by side and look at Powell's films together. Scorsese said that if you look at Fellini's 8½, Fellini would be another guy on the list, but
uh-huh.
Fellini's 8½ and Powell's Peeping Tom, those two movies will show you everything you need to know about being a movie director.
Hmm.
So those would be some of the names on my list. But I think that maybe, from everything I know about you, the guy you want to track down is Ozu.
All right.
And
now, Kurosawa.
Kurosawa is a great director, too, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I had to choose one or the other, though, I'd choose Ozu.
Hmm.
Yasujiro Ozu. He died in about 1962 or 63.
I see.
I like to put his camera... frequently, at least, not all the time, but quite frequently, at the eye level of a person who was kneeling on a tatami mat, the mats that cover the floors in traditional Japanese houses. And he observes family interaction between the generations as they try to find happiness while at the same time respecting tradition and each other.
Hmm. Roger, I'm going to give you a minute to... take the receiver away from your ear. I know it's probably giving you a cauliflower ear, and I'm going to do what I've established as a pattern these first 3 weeks on Keeping the Faith, and that is I'm going to read a poem that I've gotten permission to read.
Listen to it, Steve.
All right, a different poem each week. And for today, I have something I think a little unusual. Not a poem by a contemporary poet, but rather a poet from the 16th century, of all people, Michelangelo. Most people know Michelangelo, of course, as the sculptor of the Pietà, the David in Florence, as a painter of the Sistine Chapel, the Last Judgment, as an architect who designed the Dome of St. Peter's. But he was also a very careful writer, and wrote over 300 poems. We have over 300 still extant that he wrote. But the problem with poetry is translation. Robert Frost once said that poetry is what is lost in translation. And it takes an equally poetic translator to effectively move images and ideas and words from one language to another. And fortunately, just this last year, a master poet in English, John Frederick Nims, published a book of the complete poems of Michelangelo, translated into English. Nims is
I used to know Nims when he was at Illinois.
When he taught at the university, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After being in Champaign, he went to Circle Campus in Chicago. And I'm sad to say that I found out when I called to get permission from him to read this, this last week, that I spoke with his wife and that... Professor Nims died just this last January at age, I think, 85. But his last work is, I think, really a masterwork. And what I'd like to read is one of his translations of Michelangelo's poem. This is number 51, and it's kind of a lament. He wrote this when he was about 50 years old himself. I'll read this poem by Michelangelo translated with permission of the publisher, the University of Chicago Press, and the literary estate of John Frederick Nims. Alas, alas, for the way I've been betrayed by rushing time. By a mirror, too, that told, had I conned it close, a story all too true. It happens so when regards long overdue, like mine, for life's last end. But time's parade goes swiftly by, and overnight we're old. Too late to repent, to set things right, to hold counsel within, with death obtruding so. My own self was my foe. Of no avail how much I weep and sigh, nothing annuls the waste of days gone by. Alas, alas, reviewing all those days, there's not a one, not one. I come on there in all that time I truly call my own. All bogus hope and vain desire. I've known that my weeping, loving, burning, sighing ways, no human passion then I didn't share, hog-tied me, don't I know, remote from where God's very truth must lie. Deadly the death I die. What little time I had grows less and less. Had I more, I'd be my old self, I confess. World-weary, I plod on, no notion where, but afraid because I may know. Time gone by is a clue I cannot close my eyes to, so as the time unpeels, sloughs off my pelt, I know death and my soul match strength, contrary pair, to see which determines where my fortunes lie. If my mind's not gone awry, and I pray the Lord I'm wrong, I see me plunged headlong in eternal pain for truth abused when free to choose. Any hope at all then, Lord, for me? A lament by Michelangelo, translated by John Frederick Nims from his University of Chicago Press book, The Complete Poems of Michelangelo, published just last year. And one other, a shorter one, a sonnet. This one is number 285. So now it's over, my day's long voyage, through tumultuous ocean in a hull unsteady. I've come to the world's last anchorage, and make ready life's log with its every reckoning foul and fair. The daft delusion once so cuddled there that art was a sovereign lord to idolize, I've come to know how well was a pack of lies, such as to their grief men treasure yet as true. Fond, foolish, the lovesick longings felt before, what becomes of them? My double death approaching. One certain sure, one muttering harsh alarms. Painting and sculpture soothe the soul no more, its focus fixed on the love divine, outstretching on the cross to enfold us closer. Open arms. Another poem by Michelangelo, translated by John Frederick Nims. Some may know that Michelangelo wrote poetry as well as was an architect and sculptor and painter. A historian says that Michelangelo was responsible for the Protestant Reformation because Pope Julius II commissioned Michelangelo to design and build his tomb, which included eventually sculptures like the Horned Moses. And to get the money, Pope Julius II increased the sale of indulgences so high that Luther and other priests rebelled and demanded reform, and so ended up splitting the Christian church in two. So that notion of Michelangelo being responsible for the Protestant Reformation. Well, Roger, you may know from your studies of history. I know you were a graduate student at the University of Chicago in literature, wasn't it? English literature? Or
At U of C, yeah. I did undergraduate work at Illinois in journalism, but at U of C I was taking English, yeah.
And you may know that Michelangelo, like many of the Renaissance elite, were influenced by Neoplatonism. And Michelangelo really believed that he found in his sculpture these eternal forms that were already there that he simply uncovered.
Yes, he, you know, if you read the book by Irving Stone about the agony and the
that's the one.
Is that the one? Yeah. Where he talks about the statues already being inside the block of marble.
And my question for you, Roger, is are critics, are movie critics, Platonists, looking for that ideal form in films? Is that part of what you're about?
Oh, maybe. But, of course, film is such a conglomerate art form. Pauline Kael points out that film is like grand opera in that it isn't a pure art form so much as a combination of many different art forms. It includes drama and music and dance and pantomime and so forth. Although there are pure moments that could only be imagined on the screen. And I suppose when movies approach that, they are pure cinema. Probably silent comedy approaches it as close as anything. Keaton, in particular, approaches the what can be done on film but no place else. And because many of the films that we see could be done on a stage or, you know, on television, radio. Well, television is just a cheap, low visual quality form of film, but still. Mm-hmm.
Would you say the moving pictures are the greatest art form of the 20th century, perhaps the 21st as well?
They are the art form that emerged in the 20th century, that's for sure. No other century had moving pictures except for a few pictures that began to move at the end of the 19th. And during the last 100 years, movies have, at the beginning of the 20th century, the novel and the theater and music were the great art forms, painting. And by the end of the century, movies and its relative television, I think, have become the most widely watched and thought about of all art forms for most people. Gore Vidal, in his book Screening History, says that, incidentally, he says that he now realizes as he approaches, he hopes somewhat gracefully, his final exit, that nothing in life, not art, not sex, not anything else, has given him as much pleasure as going to the movies.
Hmm.
And then he goes on to say in the next paragraph that he's been at a good many dinner parties around the world, and frequently the conversation lags, the people don't really have anything in common. All you have to do is bring up the movies, and everybody's eyes brighten. Mm-hmm. They all start talking at once because everybody has an opinion about the movies and has a lot of affection for certain movies or dislike for other films. It's a kind of a universal subject matter. I found this out because, of course, in February, Gene Siskel died, who was my colleague on Siskel and Ebert for 24 years.
Yes.
And since then, we've been using a series of guest critics
mm-hmm.
to fill in for him 1 week at a time. And my contention is that the guest critics should be film critics. And you'd be surprised how many people say, well, you ought to put me on, or even on my brother, or my wife, or this guy I know at work. Everybody feels they're a film critic.
Sure.
It's kind of insulting in a way, the attitude that you don't need any special particular background or training.
Uh-huh.
And it's true, you don't need any training or background to have an opinion about the movies. But 3 weeks after Gene died, Stanley Kubrick died, and I realized I certainly wouldn't want to be doing Siskel and Ebert with a guest host who hadn't seen all of Kubrick's movies
sure.
or couldn't talk about them.
Sure.
And so I've been trying to say, well, let's not just get bright people in here who like to talk about the movies. Let's try to suggest that you do need to have spent some time looking at and thinking about the films of the last 100 years in order to call yourself a film critic.
Roger, I'm going to invite some of our listeners to call in and join the conversation. The number for listeners is 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Or elsewhere, you may call toll-free on our 800 line, 222-9455. So anywhere from Chicago to Indianapolis and points in between, call 1-800-222-9455 to ask questions or make comments to Roger Ebert. You are listening to Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Roger, in mentioning Gene Siskel and his passing, I know that was a horrible loss for you and his family and for his many friends. When you talk about things you've learned, I know you mentioned in your own writing that you were influenced by Dwight MacDonald, who wrote for Esquire magazine at the same time that
we were having our discussion.
That's right, in the 50s and 60s. And that was certainly a wonderful time for Esquire when they had MacDonald on films, and they had their book reviewer was Malcolm Muggeridge from England, a great...
It was the greatest magazine in the world. In those times,
I agree. You just couldn't beat it. And I know you published some of your first reviews there.
Yeah, I did. I published some interviews with people. Paul Newman, Groucho Marx, Kirk Douglas.
And we have someone who wants to join the conversation. Okay. Caller, you're on the air with Roger Ebert.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Would you repeat the website that we can get Roger's commentary on great movies on?
Yes, that's the Sun Times website. Roger, do you have that address, address?
www.suntimes.com/Ebert.
Sun
Times being one word.
Okay. And,
so in other words, it's the Chicago Sun-Times website, and then if you even get that far, you can click on me, or you can just put /Ebert and go directly there.
Super.
There are several sections there: current movies, a searchable database of the last 14 years, all my Answer Man columns for recent, you know, months, all my great movies, film festival reports, essays, interviews, news. There's a lot of stuff there. And then if you really want to go back and look at the complete archive, if you happen to be a CompuServe member, you would type Go Ebert, or you would go to the movie section of CompuServe, and you'll find many hundreds or thousands of additional reviews going all the way back to 1967, and all of my interviews and other stuff since 1990.
Oh, boy.
And AOL.com, Roger Ebert, keyword, will get you into...
No, not AOL.
No? It's not on AOL?
CompuServe.com.
Oh, is that where I found it? It
yeah.
could be.
Well, no, you probably found it on the web at the Sun-Times website, suntimes.com.
Okay.
Now,
we've
got a lot of dots going around here.
Yeah.
If you don't have CompuServe, can you still do it by typing in CompuServe?
No, if you're not a member of CompuServe, you can't get to that particular archive.
Okay.
But you can certainly get to the Sun-Times page.
Okay.
Suntimes.com/Ebert.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, caller. Appreciate it.
And then, of course, we also mentioned another. Well, we're totally confusing people, Steve.
Yes.
Might as well go ahead here and mention that the Overlook Film Festival website is called
Eberfest.
Ebert, E-B-E-R-T Fest, ebertfest.com.
www.ebertfest.com, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
We have to think up an abbreviation for www. It takes too long.
It does indeed.
How about 3U? Triple U. Instead of W, call it triple U. Of course, then people would type UUU, and that would be nowhere.
Let me invite other callers to join our conversation on WILL AM 580, 333-9455 to ask a question of Roger Ebert, or 1-800-222-9455. Glad to have you join our conversation. Roger, I know that you like to interview, and in fact, that you might prefer that to being interviewed. So I'm willing to, for a couple minutes, while we're waiting for the next call to you, for you to ask me any questions you always wanted to ask a Protestant theologian.
Do you believe that God takes a specific interest in our behavior on a daily or even hourly basis?
It's interesting that in my tradition of Calvinist or Reformed Protestant Christianity, the reason that the early pilgrims to this country preached against card playing was not so much that they were against gambling or betting or that sort of thing, but they believed that it was being rude to God to make God spend all that time deciding who would get which card each hand.
I tell you that
that's the tradition out of which I come, but that's not the type of thing that contemporary Protestant Reformed theologians would say. Although I think there is a point to saying that if God does care about people at all, if God loves folks, which is kind of a basic Christian notion, both Catholic and Protestant and Orthodox, that must include some of the details of our lives. And when Jesus taught his disciples how to pray and say, "Give us today our daily bread," that's a fairly prosaic, practical thing.
You know, I feel that when Jesus taught us to pray, he did it for our sake, not for God's sake.
I think that's right. But if we're only talking to ourselves, then I'm not sure that it's helping us much.
I think he taught us to pray to the kind of God that we could imagine.
Mm.
But I have a feeling that the totality of God is much greater than the God we can imagine.
Well,
I think that gods that have been created by religion are often in the image of man and are extremely limited. There aren't too many gods that I've read about from world religions that
mm-hmm.
to be on a scale necessary to create the universe. Most of them seem to be
rather petty.
More like, earthbound,
mm-hmm.
Seen in man's terms. And presumably, or at least plausibly, God has created an infinite number of species. We, on this planet, believe that you shouldn't murder, but what if there was a planet that has nothing on it but fish, and all the way they can live is to eat other fish?
Mm. I'm sure that our next caller, Lauren, on line two, will give us the answer to that question.
Okay.
Lauren, would you like to go ahead?
Hi, I don't actually have an answer to that question, but I watched a movie this afternoon called The Butcher Boy, and I was wondering to find out what comments you might have about that movie.
I'd be more interested in your comments. That was a very hard-edged and heartbreaking film, wasn't it?
Is this a contemporary film?
Yeah, it was made about a year ago.
Okay.
About a boy who grows up in the north of England.
Hmm.
And
well,
the caller can maybe give us a little, why don't you give us a little review of it?
Well, first of all, I was very taken with the young man who played the lead role. I don't know what his name is, but he was just amazing to watch, and you kind of kept riveted on him the whole time. It was just kind of overwhelming. I think it's something I'd go back and watch again. There were lots of things going on, and it kept taking interesting turns all the way along, and it was shocking and heartbreaking at the same time. And it was just very different. It was a very different kind of film.
I'm pulling it up on my computer right now so that I can see what his name was. Butcher Boy, here we go. Came out in April of 98. Frankie Brady was Eamon Owens.
I'm so relieved to hear you do that, Roger, and that you can't just remember it all.
Well, Eamon Owens is a name I only heard once, two years ago.
Sure.
Well, I wasn't sure whether...
It was directed by Neil Jordan, the same man who made The Crying Game.
Mm.
I wasn't sure whether the young man was, an actor in other films.
He's a young actor. And, as I'm looking at my review here, I mentioned in my review that it's a young Irish boy. I said England, but Ireland. Who turns violent and insane under the pressure of a tragic childhood. And that's the same idea, really, as in Michael Powell's movie Peeping Tom, which is going to be my great movie 2 weeks from today in the Sun-Times, the Michael Powell picture, which has been restored and is being re-released around the country. A boy whose father was a behavioral psychologist who basically treated the son very cruelly as a subject of his experiments in fear, and then developed a child who grew up to be a monster.
Well, I'll have to.
This boy has been really twisted by a cruel father, a drunken father, and a very unfriendly environment.
Mm. Well, caller, thank you for
that one. Thank you.
Thank you for telling us about Butcher Boy, and we'll go to another caller now on line three. This is Jeff. Jeff, go right ahead.
Thank you for having this program. Thank you, Mr. Ebert, for taking some time out on the Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's not much time left to address this question, but I noticed one of the films on your Forgotten Film Festival was Tron.
Yeah.
And, there's to me, one of the more interesting things about film, especially here in the late 20th century, is increasingly relying on technology, maybe in lieu of substance of characters or plot and that kind
yes.
of thing. And I was maybe you could comment really briefly about how films, how the use of technology has changed film, and also to a certain extent how films like Tron, other science fiction films, portray technology and what types of things, I don't know, do you think these are like a friendly approach to these types of things? Do we see the dark side of this? It's interesting to me that frequently these films show the dark side of technology, but at the same time are missing the point that increasingly relying on technology is sort of sapping some of the art out of these films. I just thought it was an interesting little
yeah.
paradox. So I'll hang up and listen while you comment on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, caller.
One reason that I chose Tron was that it was a 70mm film, and Tron as a movie was not overlooked. It was successful, but 70mm as a format is being overlooked. It was only two 70mm movies have been made since Tron that I know about, Far and Away with Tom Cruise and Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet.
Hmm.
So 70mm is dying, and of course the studios seem to be gearing up to replace film with video in movie theaters, which is going to be a great savings for them and a great loss for us. In the case of Tron, it's about an evil game manufacturer played by David Warner who steals the secrets of a kid, a game designer, who then travels inside a computer chip in order to get revenge or to get justice. And the movie was one of the first movies to be largely or at least partially computer-generated, although at the time, some 18 years ago, that hadn't advanced nearly as far as it has now. Today, you can do just about anything with a computer on film, as you can see if you go to look at a movie named Matrix, a new movie that uses a lot of computer special effects. To some degree, these effects are almost too good. When you see a movie like Spielberg's Jurassic Park, it's like you're looking at real dinosaurs. And in a sense, the frankly artificial creatures in movies like the traditional King Kong were scarier because they didn't look as realistic. They looked as if they were from some other plane of being.
They could do anything,
but,
right?
apart from that, what's interesting, and one of the reasons I chose Tron, of course, is that Champaign-Urbana is such a big computer center. It's the birthplace
sure.
of the web browser and the home of the National Center for Supercomputer Applications, so I thought people would be interested in looking at Tron again. But science in movies until recently generally meant evil things. You had mad scientists.
Right.
They were going to destroy the world. You had aliens from outer space, and the Army had to shoot at them because they were considered to be enemies. That was still the case with a movie like Independence Day, but increasingly with these new films that involve computers, the cyber thrillers, as they're called, movies like Dark City and The Matrix. Although there are threats, there is also kind of an intoxication with the possibilities of virtual reality and of computers.
Probably the production of humans will be like humans. It may be mixtures of good and evil, I would
yeah.
say, with some cynicism. Let me bring in one more caller we may have time for. This is Judith on line two. And Judith, welcome. But let me say that Tron will be shown Friday at 8 p.m.
Saturday at 8 p.m.
On my program it said Friday, but...
Oh, it's definitely...
It is Saturday.
...closing film, and David Warner, the actor, is going to be present in person along with Steve Lisberger, who is the director.
I do see what happened on the program. Okay, it's Saturday. Thank you, Roger. That's part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. If you'd like tickets, that number is 356-9063. Caller, go ahead. Judith?
Yes, hello. First of all, Steve, you might recognize my voice.
Ah, yes.
It's a wonderful show, and it's a pleasure to hear you and to hear Mr. Ebert. I wanted to just say, didn't the actor in Peeping Tom have a terrible time psychologically?
Yes. Carl Boehm, B-O-E-H-M,
wasn't he German actor?
Was the son of the great Austrian conductor.
Conductor, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that if you are the son of a symphony conductor, you know something about overbearing parents.
Hmm.
He actually ended his career as an actor for Fassbinder back in Germany.
I see.
Worked for him in the 70s. And had a tough time after making that film. But, of course, the film ended the career of Michael Powell, who never really recovered from the pasting that he got from people who found it to be
too
shocking.
Mm-hmm.
came out 2 months before
Psycho. Incredible how now, you know, it's being ranked as, you rank it as one of the greatest, and here it destroyed those involved in it in some ways. Anyway, I just wanted to...
Well, but that wouldn't be a reason to call it a bad film, would it?
No, not at all.
Criticize those who destroyed that. Those who made it, maybe.
What a tragedy. I'm sorry, I can't make your... I wanted to come to the Saturday afternoon, the two films you're showing
Samson
Saturday
and
afternoon.
Autumn Tale, yes.
I work then, so those were the ones that really appealed to me. I hope they make it on video here.
Well, I hope so, too. You know, Autumn Tale is one we haven't mentioned yet. It's by Eric Rohmer, a French director. It's about... It's a romantic love story, romantic comedy involving people in their 40s, grown-ups.
Well, thanks very much for doing this and remaining loyal to our community. It's a wonderful asset. And
thank you. I really hope that people do come, because that will be the only reason we'll have another one, is if people support this one. And
I'm sure they will.
I hope so, because I hope people will enjoy these films. Now, they're very different films, and you might want to go to the website or to the program that has been distributed that was printed by the Daily Illini and read some of the reviews, because not everybody will like all of these films, but there's something there for almost anyone, I think.
Well, we need a little bit of... we do have the Art Theater do a wonderful job, but we need as many as we can get.
I love the Art Theater. I did a benefit for them a couple of years ago to help them buy some seats, so that because the seats they had... we're at the wrong pitch, so people were sliding out of the seat during the movie.
But the new seats...
The Art now has wonderful new seats.
The new seats, thanks to Roger's benefit, are much better. Judith, thank you for your call, and I apologize to our last caller, Carl. We will not be able to get to you because we are out of time. And let me thank Roger Ebert, Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times and a syndicated television film critic, for being on Keeping the Faith this week.
And Steve, I hope I will see you and Nadja during the course of the week.
We look forward to seeing you at the Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival at the Virginia.
You've been listening to an archive program of Keeping the Faith from April of 1999 with our guest Roger Ebert, who sadly since that time has lost his ability to speak due to throat cancer. However, the first Overlooked Film Festival that you've heard him describing, anticipating at the time of that program, of course, has been going on successfully now for 13 years, and it starts this Wednesday, April 25th of 2012, for this Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Tickets are still available for individual shows. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. Let me remind you, WIL is able to continue because of the generosity of listeners. If you'd like to make a pledge, call 217-244-9455, or you may make your contribution online at willpledge.org. Thank you for considering a pledge to WILL.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Used stereo equipment and thousands of CDs, records, and DVDs go on sale at Vintage Vinyl, Saturday, May 5th. Don't miss the premium sale from 8 to 11 a.m. The entrance fee is $5. Free admission begins at 11, and for more information, call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503. That's 217-333-6503.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble with their final concert of the season on Saturday, April 28th at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. The program, called Music for the Theater, features Ollie Watts Davis, Elizabeth Buckley, and actors Joy Hofsamer and Henson Keys. Details are at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Jarman Center, Tuscola; Natural Gourmet, Champaign; Fertilizer Dealer Supply, Philo; and Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
WBEZ Chicago's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass, and it is a special pledge drive edition of our program, which means